is continuing with Steinberg on 8th July 76 at Medill. Okay, so that was just a little sidelight. It looks like your main... Well, then you had a follow-up paper in Annales Physique in 1950 in which you gave more details about the partial eclipse.
49. And you, 49 partial eclipse.
Right, but the paper was in 50. And you were trying to interpret it in terms of a distribution on the sun. Mm-hmm. And you said that there was a uniform disk which gave about half of the radiation, mm-hmm. and the rest came from the plage and faculae regions. Corresponding to an H alpha photograph.
Because we got them occulted one after the other. You know, at that time it was very easy. You put any kind of instrument on the sun, you would find something new. It's a time which is gone, you know.
Right.
But at that time you could. We decided to go on 1200 megacycles because first we got a radar which could get there, and second we wanted to go to higher and higher frequencies to know what the situation, how it was different from what you're getting a meter wave.
Right.
So we went to 1200 because it was the highest frequency. We had some technology expertise, and we had also a reflector. So we went to 1200 megacycles. And every time you went on a new frequency, you would find something new.
Right.
Nothing was known.
Well, there was virtually NRL, I guess, was the only other place working at such high a frequency. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
In the world at that time.
Well, maybe the Australians were already going to that kind of frequency.
Well, I guess that's right. Piddington and Minot mm-hmm. did a little bit on the.
Yes.
And also, did you think about doing the lunar observation at that high frequency? Just
no.
The thermal radiation from the moon?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we could get it. We had not enough sensitivity to look at the moon. No, we looked at the moon when we had a 3 centimeters equipment later on.
Okay, well then I see that your thesis came along in 1951.
Yeah.
And
it was,
what did it consist of?
Well, it was more or less, I used, as far as astronomical results were concerned, I used mostly the eclipse observations and all those kind of things. But basically, it was a rather thorough analysis of the use of receivers, radio receivers, as physical instruments, I mean, as physics instruments. And I also outlined a more or less complete analysis of the switching process because it was not easily understood at that time. And so that was it, you know. Now it's I don't think that anything remains on that. No. All of this is completely obsolete. But that's normal.
Well,
it's
sure, after 25 years,
yeah.
You would expect it to be.
But I don't think, you know, I don't think this is going to be any landmark, I mean, on radio astronomy. Probably Denis's thesis is more important because he got his PhD on this P3 process and he was maybe not the first, but it was very thorough and it was more or less basic physics.
I think he's the first one to do a PhD thesis in radio astronomy also.
Maybe.
Actually.
Maybe. So that's what I did. And you know, that PhD I got on my thesis, of course, but at that time, I remember that the members of the jury emphasized the some results which were in there, and they said it was among the first results in radio astronomy in France also. But at that time, they said that I was more or less the driving force of that group, you know, in Ecole Normale Supérieure. And of course, it took already quite a lot of my time. So it was also, it was not the basic reason for giving me that PhD level, you know, but the fact is that it has been mentioned at that time that I was driving that group, and so that I deserved something more than a PhD, I would say, you know. So they gave me a PhD and they gave me some congratulations or whatever it is, emphasizing that I was driving that place. And I was all the more driving it that Denis was away. I mean,
where was he gone?
Well, he was at NRL. I mean, he had been in NRL for some years. I mean, I think
One and a half?
Yes.
Oh,
he was there for half a year then, and he did it, I mean, he took it for another year.
Oh, I see. I didn't realize it was that long.
But I think it's something about that.
Right. So it was basically just you and Bloom had arrived.
Yeah.
Just
and
you two that were
working.
Yes.
Oh, well, but after that, some more people came in. I think the Leroux came in sometime, but I don't remember what year. Which year he came in.
Okay, then you had a short paper on a very short timescale burst.
From the sun.
Tenth of a second.
With Bloom, I guess.
Bloom, Denise, and Steinberg.
Yeah, well, right. these were observations at multi-frequency, several frequencies.
Right.
So we had a... at that time already, Bloom had designed meter wave receivers. And he had designed also very, very good power supplies, you know. And he had very stable power supplies, and that helped us immensely, because we had no grids anymore, and it was very stable.
Right.
And also Bloom had introduced the so-called long tail design, which is using a very large resistors in the cathode, so that there is a very high rate of DC feedback on each vacuum tube, so that they are stabilized by this process.
Long tail
circuit, which is just that the return path down to ground from the cathode is no longer a few hundred ohms, which is just used to build up the bias.
Yeah.
It's a 10,000 ohms one, which is returned to minus 90 volts. So and the grid was to ground. And so that you have a very large DC feedback on each tube, so it's stabilized by this one. So I don't remember whether he invented it or not, but the fact is that he was among the first to introduce it. And also, at that time we had very poor connectors. Tube sockets were very poor, and all connectors were very poor. So he devised the techniques by which everything was soldered, including the tubes.
I see.
And so it was the very beginning of the 7 pins, all glass tubes.
Yeah.
6AK5s and 6J4 and all those ones. And so these tubes, he managed to get them copper-plated, the pins, copper-plated and gold-plated, and soldered it. And so that it was a very heavy technology, but it proved very nice.
Right.
It worked very nice.
Right.
And so all of these are Bloom's. Bloom's introduced all that. So we got rid of drift, we got rid of poor contacts. We got rid of jumps, you know, jumps in the right
path.
And so all of this was more or less ersatz, you know, for real good components.
Yeah.
But we didn't have them, so we had to manage.
Yeah.
Bloom was at the beginning of all of that.
Hmm.
And so he designed, I don't remember whose idea it was, but he designed that receiver with 3 channels from the same antenna and same preamps. And so with that, we could do that experiment in type ones to measure their instantaneous bandwidth. It was not really a spectrograph. It was a multi-channel kind of receiver with 3 tracks at the output, and so you could see where the correlations were.
Right.
So we got the result that the bandwidth was very narrow. Now, I don't know whether we were really the first to do this or not. Maybe Charles Seeger did it.
I'm not sure either.
No. 1 year earlier, 1 year later, but it was just about the same time.
Now, by 51, Denise Steinberg and Zissler, you had 2 years of observations, and you tried to correlate what kind of optical activity centers correlated with radio and so forth. Later on, I forget who wrote that paper, these became known as Q and R regions.
Yes.
And that terminology is not stayed. I'm not familiar enough with solar radio astronomy to know, is that concept still useful?
No, but you know, at that time, Denise and myself and everybody was very eager to try to make a bridge, you know, between the radio observations and the optical observations. And so that we did a lot of work about correlation analysis, but we did not know exactly to which kind of solar features we should get a hand on.
Right.
And in fact, this problem is not clear even now. I mean, that we don't really know. I mean, there are things which are done in this observatory, Mrs. Peake and Axisa and people like these. It seems that they have a hand on that problem. But it's much more complicated than we thought, you know.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not enough that you get a sunspot, you get type 3, for instance.
Right.
You get to get special configurations of magnetic field and all of this.
Right.
And at that time, it was completely in infancy. It was just more or less a yes or no correlation. You get some kind of radioactivity and you get some kind of feature on the sun. But you don't even know which one you are talking about and which kind they belong to.
Right.
So, you know, all of this is completely obsolete. And nothing remains.
But what about this business where you said that after the radio quiet centers passed, that geomagnetic activity went down?
This is still true, more or less, because we know that the sector structure and interplanetary space. And we know that, but there is a full-fledged explanation for all of this now, which was completely unavailable at that time. For instance, a man called Caroubalos, Caroubalos, a Greek-born, he's back to Greece these days, but he has worked in France for many years. And later on, he worked with Mrs. Peake and with Simon about the time of flight of events.
Right.
From the sun, measured from the radio impact, you know, radio radiation, whatever it is, and the Earth.
Right.
And he found that there was an average delay of 2 days and things like this.
Right.
And at that time, it was digging in the dark, you know, and shooting in the dark. But now all of this is understood because we know what the interplanetary union, we know the spiral structure, and we need to know all that.
Well, at this time, you're saying that the 2 day delay between optical bursts and geomagnetic activity was not really known?
I think it was known on a purely superposed epoch basis. You know, you try to find out to fit the events, and you find peaks. And you said there is a correlation with so many days of delay, and you said that the average speed of the agent is going to be so much that it should be particle. And then that's it. And you can do very much more.
The details of the interplanetary medium and so forth,
no.
Of course, were not known.
No. But if we are going to talk about 51, I mean, 51, 52 on the next days, next years are very important. For the development of radio astronomy in France.
Well, because of the solar eclipse, are you
yes,
saying?
Because
yes,
because of the solar eclipse in 51, and also because, if I may be immodest, of the fact that I went to Sydney in 1952. And this is where the Nansei station starts.
I see. Well, let's talk about that eclipse. That's the one in French Sudan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's a interesting and funny story. In that sense that Denis discovered on the post office almanac that there was an eclipse. I think it was in September.
Right.
And he discovered this at the normal time almanacs are distributed, which is the 1st of January.
Right.
And so he came to us and said, well, there is an annual eclipse to be observed in 1951. And at that time, we had a 3 centimeters equipment operating, and we had the meter with 169 megacycles equipment of Bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And the 3 centimeters was more or less myself. I designed and built. And so the 3 centimeters one was built around a 1.5 meters diameter Navy searchlight, an American Navy searchlight,
mm-hmm.
which we got in the surplus. We got two of them.
Hmm.
And so I built a 3 centimeters radiometer from this, with a horn and a switch, light dicker, and
mm-hmm.
between two channels, and a superheterodyne line receiver, balanced mixture.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing very new now, but at that
right.
time it was just, it was a front of the technology.
State of the art.
Okay, but in any case, in 51, Denis discovered on the PDT almanac that there was going to be an eclipse. So he looked into the annual of the longitude, American ephemeris, and he found out first that it was an annular eclipse. I think it was 0.975. And second, that the totality zone crossed the Niger River in what was at that time French West Africa, at the only point where there was any industrial base, which was the Markala Dam,
mm-hmm.
which was built, I don't remember when, but for irrigation purposes. And they were trying to grow rice in that area. And so that he knew that place apparently because he had been a teacher during the war in Dakar.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very young and very eager to visit all everywhere. And so
right.
he went to that place and lots of other places, even with his students, who were not very much younger than he was.
Mm-hmm.
And so he visited many and many places in West Africa, and even Central Africa, on bicycles. And so he knew that place, and he said, by God, it's the place we must go.
Yeah.
Because in that place, this is the only place in French West Africa where we can find a welder, for instance.
Right.
So, okay, here we go. So we decided we would go. But the only problem is that was not planned by any agency, so there was no money available.
Right.
So we went to the official agency, which is supposed to provide money for the eclipses, and we got, at that time, 300,000 francs, at that time, to go. So we realized that we would not go with that money. So we said, okay, we are going to ask the Navy. And we had connections with the Navy, which were from Wacker.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Navy said, okay, we are going to transport yourself and some of the equipment on planes. And we are going to take everything on ships, and we shall get you to Dakar. At Dakar, there was a big arsenal, so you can get support from there. And eventually, they even paid our trip to Bamako.
I see.
And then we were on trucks to Markala. And so, in fact, we flew on long dock planes, piston engines, from Paris to Morocco and Morocco to there, because they could not fly one faster. So they flew us to Casablanca and Casablanca to Dakar. And in Dakar we got our equipment from a ship, a Navy ship. And then everything was loaded on the Dakar-Niger railway, which is a narrow gauge railway, and with ourselves. And remember that the Navy people, including that Seligman I told you about, who was at that time he was in Paris, but he went with us to Dakar, and of course he knew everybody on the Navy base there,
right.
And he got us cars, you know, right. To visit the place, and he got us a refrigerator. And he told us, well, look, our friends in here, they told me that we might take a refrigerator. So we said, no, we don't need any refrigerator, we can manage. And he insisted we should take the refrigerator. Ah, by God, we were very thankful because it was very hot.
Right.
So we are going. We are given one of these buildings they have in these places to house all our equipment. And so we had an American type of meter wave radar, which was made of two square or rectangular frames,
mm-hmm.
upon which Blum had mounted a number of dipoles. And they were mounted also on an horizontal girder, which can be moved in azimuth, in elevation, and the whole thing could be moved in azimuth.
Right.
So the latitude at that place was very low. So we could tilt the supposedly vertical axis to the proper
right.
inclination, which was a few tenths of degrees, I think 15, something like that. And it was mounted in a huge T-shaped mount, which was welded on the spot at Marcala, because there were welders and everything necessary. And the thing would turn around the elevation axis,
right.
which was at that time the declination axis. And so that worked beautifully.
So you turned it by hand in azimuth?
In azimuth you had no reason to turn it because the vertical axis was tilted parallel to the earth axis. And so you had only to turn it... I'm wrong.
You had to track it in azimuth still.
Yes, we tracked in azimuth, that fixed the declination.
Right. But you turned that by hand?
Oh yes,
with an ephemeris.
Well, but you know the beam was 20 degrees or 30 degrees, there was no problem. And so we got observations of an annular eclipse, optically annular eclipse, at 169 megahertz with a perfect stability of the whole thing, and it worked good. And so we had also a 1.5 meters searchlight,
mm-hmm.
and the American Navy operated at 3 centimeters, and which was also an equatorial mount. And which worked on the sun, and we got eclipse curves, which were not very good because the tracking was poor.
Hmm.
Because of course they were, the requirements of tracking were much harder than meter waves.
Right, right.
So the observations on meter waves, they were interesting because we found a result, which is that the curve was not symmetric. The eclipse curve in meter waves was not symmetrical. And so we deduced that as most of the radiation was coming out from the corona has not a spherical symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
And this was later on confirmed by other observations, maybe 1 or 2 years later, 54, I guess, by another partial eclipse which was observed from different places.
This is where you talked about the equator being wider.
Longer, the equatorial size is longer than the polar size.
Right.
And so 1 or 2 years, I think 2 years later, we got, I think it was 54, we got observations from Sweden, Tunisia, and maybe Dakar.
Right.
Because Denis went to Dakar for some years as more or less professor at the university there.
I see.
And so he kept the equipment, the meter waves equipment, he kept it in there. Another one was moved by Blum and myself to Sweden on a vertical.
Mm-hmm.
And a third one was taken to Tunisia, I think by Casas.
I see.
So we got 3 points observations. And so we got more or less the shape of the corona and meter waves.
Did Denise do any other observations in Africa?
All routine ones.
Yeah. Was there anybody else that observed this eclipse, or were you the only group?
I don't.
The NRL went to Sudan, I think, but that was later.
Oh, you mean in 52? In 51?
I mean the 51 eclipse.
Well, I don't know. It was an annual eclipse, you know. It was a very little
interesting people. I think the one that NRL went to was a total eclipse. You know.
Yes, I think that there was nobody to the 1951 eclipse. But I think now I remember that the second eclipse I'm going to talk is not 54, but it's 52.
Well,
and in 52, Lafinaire moved to Egypt.
I don't think...
He went in 52 he went to observe the eclipse in Egypt.
I see.
In Egypt with Leo, and Leo died in Egypt. He carried optical observations and he died.
Hmm.
He died in Egypt.
I see.
In 52. L-Y-O-T.
But now you were not involved in that.
No.
In those observations, right?
No, I don't think so. But I don't remember if these partial eclipse observations and meter waves at two or three different places were carried out in 52 or in 54. I would guess it's 52.
Yeah.
And I think I did not go. I did not go to any of these observations myself. Denis was stationed, I would say, in Dakar because he was teaching there. And Blum and myself, oh no, I don't think so, it's not true. Because the Sweden observations were not involved in 52, because we went with the Blums in Sweden in 54. And it was for 1955, which was awesome.
Yeah, Sweden was, where's the date of that?
Well, it should be 55. Because I remember that we drove up to Sweden with Mrs. Blum and myself and my wife and myself, and the two Blums and the two Steinbergs drove up to Sweden in 1954 to organize an eclipse observations, which should have taken place in 54.
That sounds, I can't find it here, but
so I think that in 52 there were observations only in France, Marcoussis, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and Tunisia, as I remember, and Dakar.
Now, from these eclipses, you are of course trying to get the distribution
yes.
of the radiation,
mm-hmm.
and at meter wavelengths, the primary result that you found was that the corona was elliptical
mm-hmm.
shaped more than spherical. Mm-hmm. At centimeter wavelengths, you have an article in Nature in 52
mm-hmm.
in which you talk about the 3 centimeter observations imply limb brightening.
Yeah,
which of course was a debate at that time.
Oh yes, it's still it.
As to how much and at what wavelengths the sun is limb brightened.
Mm-hmm.
You were, it seemed to me from looking at the abstracts of your papers, you were always taking the side that there was limb brightening, is
yes.
this correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we carried out interferometer observations later on with Alon and Arsac. And
right,
that's 3 centimeters.
In 53,
mm-hmm.
right,
53,
using a changeable baseline and
yes.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But now, if I remember correctly, well, but that's right. The Cambridge observations were at much longer wavelengths.
Yeah.
And they did not find limb brightening, isn't that correct?
Oh, no, but there is no limb brightening to find. You mean at Cambridge? But at Cambridge, they were not operating on centimeter waves.
Right, they're much longer.
Or on meter waves. On
yeah.
Them. And on meter waves, nobody ever expected limb brightening.
Yeah.
But they get limb brightening and it's a,
yeah.
it's a very smooth shape in general.
Now, looking back on the early 50s and those limb brightening observations, how would you say that they stand up relative to what later
is known
observations?
Now? Well, I think that now most people think that there is no limb brightening at 3 centimeters. So the problem probably, well, I don't know, but maybe we got mistaken or we wrongly interpreted in the wrong way the whole thing. I mean, that it's known that to make sure that you get limb brightening, you must have a two-dimensional directivity, I mean, two-dimensional beam, which is very small, because if not, you get active centers, you know, on the limb, and you cannot discriminate between limb brightening, really, and an active center.
Right.
And it was not really clear.
So when you have a solar eclipse, it just gives you a knife edge.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which
it gives you a knife edge, and you don't know whether this is an active activity of some kind, which is in the limb near the aureole zone, or whether this is actually limb brightening. But in fact, you know, it's still disputed. You get observations, and there were papers 1 or 2 years ago by Ziering, for instance, who claimed that he analyzed in details this limb brightening problem, and he said that there are no convincing evidence that there is any limb brightening at all, and if there is no limb brightening, one should explain why.
At any radio wavelength?
At any radio wavelength, including down to millimeter waves.
I see.
But apparently, now at millimeter waves, there is evidence for limb brightening from 1 minute of our beams.
Right.
And then you know. Two-dimensional beam,
right.
not the...
Well, I think the Kitt Peak antenna, for instance.
Yeah, Kitt Peak antenna, yeah. Even, I think, the Bund people carried out down 2 centimeters or something like this with 100 meters diameter.
Right.
Or maybe only they can use 70 meters, but even so.
Right.
So it's whether we are right or wrong in the early 50s, it has taken 20 more years to be sure.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But even if I were wrong, I'm ready to accept it. I mean,
well, but the thing is, what I'm interested in is the nature of the debate at that time. Who were the people that were claiming that there was no limb brightening? Do you remember?
No, I don't know. But I know that we understood perfectly what the issue was. I mean, you know, the transition zone physics. I mean, transition zone physics. And,
between the chromosphere and the corona.
And we understood it was very important to know. I mean, how optically thick or optically thin it was.
Right.
So I understand why we were chasing that kind of result. But in fact, it was not clearly apparently it's not yet.
Yeah.
You know, I have given a talk. I gave a talk in Boulder 3 weeks ago, or something like this, in which I am advocating that in meter waves, we have evidence of the hyperstructure of the corona, and from these telescopic observations we have carried out. And there was a German who stood up, who is called Pfister, I know him very well, and he said, "Well, I'm very glad to hear this because we have evidence of hyperstructure at centimeter waves for interpreting our limb breaking bit."
So it's with the, taken with the Bunn telescope, and apparently they have very so weak limb brightening that they have to resort to a very inhomogeneous structure to explain it. So you know the problem is still alive, it's still there.
Okay. Well, let's move on. In 53 you mentioned that Alon and Arsak worked with you on this changeable baseline.
Yes, variable baseline interferometry.
And Arsak is a person who worked on minimum redundancy arrays and so
yes.
forth. Where does he fit in? I don't know much about
him. He fit
him.
In, you know, he was a student of the École Normale Supérieure with other people. Later on, for instance, Leke came in the group this way. And he was working towards, something like an MSc, you know, which they have to get before they go to aggregation level. The aggregation level has no equivalent anywhere else. So it's something which is typically French. But in any case, he came in. And he wanted to have a theme, you know, to work on. So we suggested him this one.
I see.
And he got interested in that kind of thing, and he was a very deep-thinking man. So he investigated all the physics of these arrays. And by the way, this is about the time we invented the Christensen array, independently from Christensen. But in fact, we did
not... You mean the grating interferometer?
Oh, yes, the grating interferometer. Right. We invented it... in about that time, even before I went to Australia.
When you say we, you mean Arsak was involved?
No, myself and a guy who has no name in radio astronomy, who is called Aigrain, Aigrain, and who later became interested in solid-state physics, and he's one of the best physicists we ever had in France. Now he's heading research in a big firm, but he has been a very good man in solid-state physics. And he was back from the States as a Navy officer, where he was supposed to learn radar. And he was very deep, his mind was very deep, and so he studied nearly everything he could learn. And so he came in, and I started talking to him, and we discussed lots of things. And I told him, well, look, we have a problem, which is that we need to have as narrow a beam as we can. And I told him, why should we need, really, to have only one beam? Is it not in a way to build a thing which is simple, and which has several beams, but which were so... separated in space so that we shall see only our object in only one of the beams.
Yeah.
And he said, yes, maybe this is something we can think about it. And he came back later and he said, but that's trivial. And so he outlined it was good, you know, he knew better physics than I did probably, and he came up with the Christensen array.
Well, of course, it is a standard grading in a physics.
Oh, problem. Okay, but he made the bridge, you know, he closed the gap,
right.
which I didn't.
I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
That's
and so he came, and we built one. We built one with four antennas, and working at 40 centimeters, 750 max.
Now, was this where
at
was
Marcus
this? This is Marcus.
But at what time I can't tell you. It was made of four cylindrical parabolas. It was the antennas were designed by Zeissler.
I see.
And some of the connections we built, and we built a receiver, but I think we never really used it because we had lots of other things to do. But I'm not claiming that we invented it before Chris, because in fact we never did anything with it. There is nothing to claim.
Well, you independently came upon the idea.
It's just fun. But you know, you should not skip the year 52, because the year 52 is very, very important.
Oh, that's right. You said you went to Sydney, right?
Yes, I went to Sydney, and was the IAU meeting on the IRSI meeting. So Leffiner was the official delegate of IAU astronomy. And finally, I've got half of the trip paid. And so, of course, I could not get there with half of the trip paid. So I went to the boss of a big electronics firm, which was called Pont, P-O-N-T-E. And Pont discovered the electron scattering at the same time as Davison and German did. So he missed the Nobel Prize.
But he was very bright. He was mm-hmm. he was trained at Ecole Normale Supérieure also. So he was president, I mean, chairman of the board of the firm. And I knew him just because he came to the Ecole Normale from time to time. But I have never been very shy. So I phoned to his secretary. I told him, well, look, I'm going to Australia. What can I do for the firm? Because I need some of the money. So he told me, come and see me. So I went to him. He told me, well, it's no problem for me to pay the rest of your trip. But you will go to Melbourne and see our agent there. And then you will come back and report to me about the situation of our firm in Australia. So did I. but this is another story. And so I went to the RSC meeting in Sydney. So I visited the Potts Hill Christian Seminary.
Right.
And I visited all their sites. And when I came back, for one reason or the other, Denis was, I guess, in Dakar. So I went to Ocar and I told him, well, look, if the radio astronomy is going to have any future in France, we need a big station with a big piece of land. Because if not, we cannot do anything. We are going to be completely taken over by everybody. And so we shall play with small instruments with no resolving power. And it's impossible. So we may do something. So Ocar told me, okay, I'm going to think about this. And a few weeks later, he told me, well, look, I think you are perfectly right. And you need a big piece of land and a specialized observatory to do this. And I'm going to try to see whether we can get the money. So he placed a number of phone calls without me.
Yeah.
And finally, once upon a time, he told me, okay, we have got an appointment with Madame Lemaire, L-E-M-A-I-R-E, who is the boss of higher studies budget at the Minister of National Education. And we're going to see her with you, and we're going to see whether we're going to get the money for it.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me, you have better to write down, as soon as you can, you have better write down a proposal and a budget. I said, okay, and I started doing it, because I have always been very practical, you know, so I like to do this. And so I said, okay, I came up with a budget, which was 25 million of the francs at that time. So we went to visit Madame Le Maire, and the only thing I remember from this is that Madame Le Maire was in charge of budgeting, you know, all research right. projects outside of seminars. She was very happy of that project for two reasons. First reason is that she became sick of subsidizing small projects at the level of $100 or something, because nothing ever came out of it. Or she thought so.
Yeah.
And second, that project was very spectacular. Okay? So in 1 hour of discussion, we got 25 million support.
Amazing.
And then we came back, Ocar had a car and a chauffeur.
What did your proposal, well, go ahead.
The proposal was to build a specialized radio astronomy observatory somewhere in France.
And
mainly for studying the sun at that time, but to build big antennas with the resolving power. Okay, so then we came back to Professor Ocar's office, and he told me, well, look, you got 25 million to do this. You go ahead and keep me informed, that's all. But you manage.
Hmm.
Okay, so I did. And so, with Bloom, more or less, we started looking for a piece of land.
Hmm.
So we called for...
This is when, what year now, 53 or...?
This was 53.
Okay, before we go further, can I just ask you, what did you learn at Sydney at that meeting?
I realized that there were ways of building high-resolution antennas, you know, on a large scale, and it was badly needed because the Australians already had them. And so if we could not compete in sensitivity and especially in resolution in space, we are just out.
Right.
There was no need of getting any more. We have better to change fields. So it was absolutely needed to have a huge piece of land. The basic thing was a huge piece of land to put huge antennas. And so it was quite clear, you know, all communications we got there were obtained with high resolution as far as they can. Interferometers or Christian Seminary.
Right.
Okay, so then I went to Ocar, as I told you. So then we started looking for a piece of land, and we published, we called newspaper people, newspapermen, you know, and we told them, well, look, we got the money to build a specialized radio astronomy observatory, and France has done this and that already, you know. We started building up a lobby, or whatever it is, you know, campaigning to get the land, because it was not very easy to get a piece of land as big as we wanted. We wanted a 1 mile east west. And if possible, 1 mile north out, which is a big piece of land. We wanted it flat. We wanted it away from industrial areas so that we would not get too much interference. It was not easy, you know. France is not a very densely populated country, but even so, I mean,
right.
you cannot travel all over the country as long
right.
as you find a place. So we called the newspaper people, more or less a press conference, whatever it was.
little them here we are. I mean, we have done this and that, for such and such reasons we need a piece of land, so help us. And we got two or three articles published in paper. I mean, namely, there was one by a guy who's still alive, who's called Lott, L-O-T, and he was a science writer in Le Figaro. And so we got letters pouring in. And we had cars at the time, and so we went to visit some of these people with them. And finally, we never got a piece of land we looked for this way. But we got somebody in the lab who was called André, A-N-D-R-A, and he was the son of a notary in Vierzon. And he instructed us that there was a man in Nancy who was looking for people to buy some of his land. And this is where we got the Nancy piece of land.
There were no government forests or anything like this that you could use?
No, first we did not want to use forests because we did not want to cut trees to do this. We wanted as far as we could a bare piece of land, and not too many trees.
Well, but Nancy is a forest.
No. There is a forest on it, but there was enough room, you know, there was already some room without too many trees. And also, we were looking for a place where the trees were not very worth it, I mean, were not very valuable.
For lumber, yeah.
Because if not, you would have to buy it also. And so there was a long period of bargaining, which was funny. I mean, I have no regrets. But it took a lot of hard time.
Yeah.
And then we started looking for building a station. And but Bloom was busy, and so when I came back from Australia, I said what we should build is a Christian seminary on meterways. So I suggested that to all the members of that group.
That was because Christian's was at
21 centimeters.
Right, so
21 centimeters. So we were already active in meterways, and we knew there were lots of bursts to be observed and lots of physical solar physics problems. And so I came back with this idea. I mean, we should have a big piece of land. And second, the first thing we should build is a huge array on meterways. And the fun is that then Bloom said, okay, I'm going to build it. And so he was very happy to build it, and we got some of the money to build it. And so he built it. This is his tribe.
Mm-hmm.
But I built the station,
right,
which is my
right.
tribe. And Denise came back from Dakar
when
the thing, or well, I would say 54 or so, 53 or 54. I mean, the station was right on its way. We bought the piece of land in 53, and I think that by the end of 54, or the fall of 54, the first building was up.
Mm-hmm.
And the east-west platform was built at that time. We hired the army engineer to do it, because it was not really very much cheaper than using a private firm, but it was more flexible.
Mm-hmm.
So we got two or three big bulldozers and scrappers and everything from the army, and there was a sous-officier, we call it. You get officers, and below them you get
sub-officials?
Well, I don't know what the term in the army, because I had never been in the army myself.
Oh.
But the fact is that you get soldiers, I mean GIs, and you get
sergeants.
Commissioned sergeants.
Yeah, non-commissioned officers.
Non-commissioned officer, and so on. There was one. And the others were all called, people called in the forces for regular service.
Right.
And so they were very happy, because they lived in a hotel, in Nossa village, and they were nearly as free as birds.
Right.
And the non-commissioned officer was in the army. I mean, he was a professional officer, but he was also very happy, you know. And so they did the job in a very flexible way, you know. I mean, they were not worrying about one or more thousand kilometers, you know.
Right.
Trees to cut or whatever it was.
So
they built the platform, and we erected a white, very white red flag on it. And aside of it, there was a road so that the Bloom could build all the 5 meter dishes.
Right. But now this platform was for the first array, the meter.
No, the platform was going to accommodate two instruments. One instrument was a Christensen grating array, which Bloom designed.
And what were the elements of this array?
5 meter dishes. 5 meter diameter dishes mounted on concrete mounts.
And for what frequency?
169 megahertz. And there was also a 6 meter gauge rail track to accommodate two of these vertebrates, because at that time we had two.
Right.
And an immovable variable band, baseline interferometer to be operated at 900 megahertz. And the man in charge of this was Leroux, and the second man, the junior man, was Lequeur.
I see.
And Lequeur got his PhD on this instrument.
Right. Yeah, I've talked to Lequeur about his...
You will see that there are no. You will see. You will get. I mean, if you get in touch with all these people, one after the other, and I hope you can do that, there, you will find very few points where there are divergence of opinions. We are keeping together very well.
Right.
We have no problems. So it would just be by accident that I would express an opinion which is not exactly there.
Well, and sometimes memory is...
Yeah, that's it. But normally we have no frictions.
So
this is the way it starts.
So that's the way the non-say station got started, I see.
But for us it's very important, you know, because all the future development of ideas probably was based on the non-say station.
Let me just ask about a couple of the odd papers in this time. In the popular journal Astronomie, you wrote about a comparison between optical and radio techniques, which is sort of interesting because, like I say, most people working in radio astronomy at that time were not really much concerned with optical astronomy. They were just worried about the radio. What made you think this way?
Nothing special. I mean, it just came up to my mind. But, you know, there are not always reasons. I mean, nothing said. I don't remember. Maybe this is connected to that book we wrote, but I don't remember when we wrote it, and so maybe it's not connected at all.
You mean
book,
we
wrote a book with Lequeux, and we wrote a book, and then at that time we had to think about the way of explaining things.
Right.
So maybe this is connected to it, but I cannot tell you what the dates are.
But that was 6 years before the book finally came out, anyway.
Oh yes, but we had this idea of the book much earlier. I don't remember how it fits in. At the École Normale Supérieure, we had to give lectures. And also at that time I started to give what we call free courses, I mean at the university. So that, because I wanted to more or less impose radio astronomy to the normal curriculum.
Right.
And it was needed, because nobody would come in by himself. I mean people are, you know, they work on a given line and they find very difficult to look on the side.
You got to broaden there.
So I tried to do something like this, and I wanted to officialize the existence of radio astronomy in the normal curriculum in Sorbonne. So maybe that came from the fact that I had to give talks. I mean, I gave lectures on a free-willing basis. They were recorded normally by small posters, but I was not paid for it.
Right.
And I suggested myself to do it. Maybe it had been useful, maybe not, I don't know. But it was useful to me, because I had to produce a formal expose.
I see. So,
maybe that was connected.
So the book sort of grew out of those lectures.
Okay. In L'Astronomie, you know, L'Astronomie is not really a scientific journal.
Right.
I mean, it's more or less the internet used by amateurs.
Right.
And there were no radio astronomy amateurs, and most people in the audience would start from their concepts of optics.
Sure.
Maybe it's the reason, I don't know.
Okay. Now, this is skipping ahead a little bit, but I notice here, Alon Kundu in Steinberg in 57, you had a 3-centimeter interferometer, 2 dishes, and you talk about the variable spacings that you can get just from different hour angles, which of course is aperture synthesis.
Yes.
Really.
Well, but we didn't really notice it was aperture synthesis.
Well, that's what I was going to ask.
Oh, yes, we did not. We did not. It was the wrong object to do this anyway, because it's unstable.
The sun is
not stable. It's not stable enough.
It's varying in intensity.
Yeah. It was even supersynthesis, by the way, because we used
our right.
But we cannot claim anything about this. I mean, we did not realize.
Well, this was the same time. This was precisely the same time when Ryle's group was developing the concepts of synthesis.
Yes, sure chance. But between 51 and 56, we made regular routine 3-centimeter observations. And we had a 1.5 meters dish on the roof of the École Normale Supérieure, which was used for an eclipse, partial eclipse observation. But what is more interesting is that we found these more or less simulations. The scintillation of sources, of solar sources.
That was Kazis in Steinberg 57, when you published that, is that right?
Yeah, but we found this, I mean, we discovered, if I may say so, it's not really a big discovery, but we noticed that kind of phenomenon during the observations we carried out on the roof of the École Normale Supérieure.
I see.
3 centimeters. When did they start? I don't know. Maybe we already observed the 1954 at least. But the fact is that we found these simulations and variations and all this. And then we thought, maybe this is connected to the nature of the horizon, which were just roofs, you know, lots of flats. And so then we decided to move that equipment to Nancy. Because in Nancy, the horizon is made of trees.
Right.
So it would be completely different. We would see whether we find the same phenomenon or not. And then later on, we decided we would have a second one. And the first one was mounted on a tower, movable on a 6-meter track. And that ended up with Kazes PhD.
I see. And what exactly was the phenomenon now? Can you use this one?